Hi, everyone. Nice to be here. And I think our chairman said before the talk, this will be a completely uncontroversial talk. And you will all be convinced that we know the value of H&R. Is that what you said? That's what you said. So we have come a long way in measuring distances in the last few decades. And really, starting with HST, we've been able to measure distances to better than a factor of two. It's hard to believe that 30 years ago, we were still arguing about the distance scale at a factor of two. And now we're arguing, key project measured the Hubble constant to uncertainty of 10%. And in the last couple of decades, Adam and his group, our group, have continued to refine the Cepheid distance scale. And Adam's group is now measuring a Hubble constant to precision and accuracy of better than 2%. And we've been continuing to bring down the errors in the Cepheid distances. What I'm going to describe this afternoon is a completely different, from the grounds up, redetermination of the distance scale based on the tip of the red giant branch. And you may have heard the talk earlier this morning by Insung Jang that presented results on the tip of the red giant branch. But for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a measure of the position of the luminosity of essentially what is the core helium flash. When you look at an external galaxy, and in our case, what we do is we point the Hubble Space Telescope at the halo of nearby galaxies, and we look for the discontinuity. There was another. Oh, thank you. The discontinuity in the luminosity or the magnitude where the stars cease to climb the red giant branch. And we're observing the helium flash. I'll go into this a little more. We measure the luminosity function, essentially the first derivative of the luminosity function. We run an edge detector over that luminosity function. And so we can quantitatively assess what the position of the luminosity of the tip of the red giant branch is. And so what we've done with Hubble is to observe a sample of galaxies that have type 1a supernovae in them in the way the Shoes group has done for Cepheids. So here is what we get. I won't make you wait. We get a value of 69.8 plus or minus 1.9. This here is compared to the CMB observations and the Planck analysis. Now, that would be in the absence of the Cepheid measurements, and I think that would require Adam to go back to the future and maybe his parents never met. So if we add in the Cepheid data, this is from the Shoes group, and this is the recent result from Holy Cow, and we take the local average from the nearby distances, then we would get a value of about just under 73, and there would be a 4.3 sigma tension with Planck. So the paper has just been posted to the archive. It's available today, and these are the most recent observations by the Holy Cow group. Okay, so how did we get here? As I said, this is an independent path H-naught. So what I'm showing you is an analysis where the data in the two columns are completely independent. There's nothing that is the same. The local distances come from the tip of the red giant branch. There are 18 supernovae now that are calibrated with the tip of the red giant branch. We use the Carnegie Supernova Project. This was launched. Mark Phillips and I were co-PIs at Las Campanas, measuring supernovae nearby with 9 different filters observed with very high cadence. A small sample relative to some of the surveys, but our attention was for systematics. Can we determine reddenings well? Can we determine metallicities well? Can we observe them well before maximum, well spaced, so that it's a very high quality data set? And the calibrator that we're using at the moment is the Large Magellanic Cloud. Our intention was to use Gaia. We will eventually use Gaia and parallaxes for TRGB stars in the Milky Way. We have an ongoing program at Las Campanas with a robotic telescope, and we're monitoring about 2,000, in fact, increasing the sample to probably be 4,000 stars by the time the Gaia calibration is available, and we're going to extend that into the infrared. And so we will calibrate with sub-percent parallaxes ultimately when Gaia is available. At the moment, our calibrator is the Large Magellanic Cloud. The Shoes sample, there are 19 galaxies for which they have Cepheid distances. They used a bunch of different surveys that Dan Holtz has put a lot of effort into bringing onto a consistent scale, including the Carnegie Supernova. Oh, whoops. That's right, I'm getting rid of everybody. That's and the SHOES group uses three calibrators at the moment. I'm putting the LMC in brackets because we have the opportunity to ignore the LMC for the Cepheids and do a completely independent comparison. So based on the Milky Way and 4258 for the Cepheids and LMC for the tip of the Red Giant Branch. So no data in common, which I think is a real advantage. So the current tension, we've seen this a lot in the last few days, but let me just show you my version of it, which plots here the key project value of the Hubble constant that we published in 2001, and the value of the Hubble constant that's been published primarily by Adam and the SHOES group up until this year. And then we had this Carnegie Hubble project calibration using the Spitzer Space Telescope in 2012. But what you'll see is that the value of the Hubble constant really hasn't changed all that much. What has changed is the size of the error bars. And the most recent CMB measurements, again starting from early in the 2000s with WMAP, those values have come down, and so have the uncertainties quite considerably. And if we compare, first I other Dan, Dan Skolnick, apparently didn't disappear. And here's the gravitational wave siren, neutron star binary H-naught result. And the tension may be 4.4 sigma with just SHOES and Planck alone, not yet adding holy cow at about 4.4 sigma. And here's where we end up today, so with the new TRGB result. Now, so you can see we don't have as long a history here as the Cepheid and the CMB results. This is a work in progress. We are continuing to refine this analysis. As in any method, we have systematics, as do the Cepheids, but they're independent systematics, and we're continuing to work those, so stay tuned for future progress. So, Cepheids, a lot of advantages. Why do we like them so much? They've been tested, well tested, for many decades now. They're luminous. We heard this from Insung this morning. They have a very small dispersion in the period luminosity, or the Levitt law relation. And in the I band here, shown for the key project sample, the dispersion is about 2/10 of a magnitude. That's 10% in distance. So theoretically, if you had 100 Cepheids in your galaxy, you're getting a better than percent distance to the galaxy. The issue, of course, is systematics. It's always systematics, and that's what we're interested in understanding. What is the current level of the systematics in both the Cepheid and the TRGB distance scales? Now, we understand physically what the period luminosity relation is about. We've studied this for many years. There is a relationship between luminosity period and temperature. That's a physical effect. So people who are actually minimizing the scatter in the PL relation, you're taking away a real physical effect. Temperature correlates with color. There's a period luminosity color relation, very well known. And one of the advantages of the astrophysical methods, including Cepheids and TRGB stars, is that you can test for systematic effects. It's not simply a line of sight issue, what's along your line of sight, for example, but is there a metallicity effect? Is there reddening? Can we use multi-wavelength photometry to tease out those effects? And that's been done. Here's the current status for Cepheids. These are period luminosity relations by the SHOES group. Enormous effort with HST that Adam and collaborators have undertaken. We know in the Large Magellanic Cloud, we can measure the period luminosity relation to very high accuracy nearby. The scatter in the LMC ranges from about 1/10 to 2/10, depending on what wavelength you're observing at. But even in the Maser galaxy that we heard about from Mark Reed, which is at 7 megaparsecs, the scatter already goes up to about 4 times what it is what we measure in the Large Magellanic Cloud in the H-band. So these are tough observations. By the time you're trying to move out with Cepheids, Cepheids are young stars. You find them in regions of star formation. They're in the disk. You're trying to extract the photometry against the disk, bright disk of the galaxy. There are dust clouds and so on. It's a very difficult undertaking. So the challenges remain whether there's a metallicity effect. We developed a technique to use H2 regions as a proxy just before the key project. because we couldn't measure the metallicities of the Cepheids directly. They're too faint. We can't get spectra of the distant ones. So we look at the H2 regions, and we hope that they're a measure of some indication, at least, of the Cepheid metallicity. The reddening is large in the disk. That means you need accurate colors. This is the reddening-free, the magnitude in the H-band that the Shoes et al. Group use. So you need an H-band observed magnitude. You need a observed magnitude in the V-band at about 5,500 angstroms. And you also need an observed in the I-band magnitude. So you have to have very accurate colors. And if you're measuring, again, against the disk of other stars that are crowding your objects, that's a significant worry as you go farther and farther out in distance. We haven't even thought about stellar evolutionary effects. So what keeps me awake with Cepheids? Why do I worry about them still? What systematics could there be? Stellar evolutionary effects. Cepheids actually cross the instability several times during their lives. There may be a period mass, period age relation. Does that correlate with metallicity? We don't know. We just use the period luminosity relation. Something when we're thinking about 1% effects, maybe that's important. We don't yet know. There are small numbers of galaxies for which you can measure both supernovae and Cepheids. This is also true for the TRGB. The problem is supernovae are rare, and maybe one every 2 or 3 years goes off that's near enough to be accessible with HST to measure Cepheids and tip of the Red Giant branch. So we had to wait a long time to build up even the samples of 18 and 19 objects. The I think most significant worry is the crowding and blending effects, which worsen with distance. There's no way out of that. Resolution decreases. The tip of the Red Giant branch, as I mentioned, this is the position of the core helium flash. You've got a degenerate helium core for these low-mass stars. These are generally stars in the halo. They're less than one solar mass stars that have evolved to the Red Giant phase. They've got a degenerate helium core surrounded by a hydrogen-burning shell. The star is ascending the Red Giant branch, getting brighter in luminosity, till it reaches a temperature of about 100 million degrees. You suddenly have more phase space available. You break the degeneracy. The core helium flash occurs. And then the triple alpha process takes over. The star decreases in luminosity, becomes bluer, and settles onto the horizontal branch. And as I said, what we see empirically, we look at a population of stars in the halo, we see the stars on the giant branch, and then we see this truncation where we no longer have stars above the core helium flash. There are asymptotic giant branch stars. They're less common. We actually see them as a background. They're a background source of noise, but we can still measure this edge, as I'll show you. It's been modeled, the evolution of Red Giant branch stars, for many, many decades. Many groups have done it, and recently it's been redone by several groups. The issue in terms of empirically using the tip of the Red Giant branch for distance indicators, we've known for a long time that in the I band at about 8,800 angstroms, the tip of the Red Giant branch is rather flat. Insung showed you today nicely. It's very weakly correlated with age for stars that are older than 4 gigayears. And there is an effect with metallicity. We see that effect with color. And primarily, it's seen at other bands. In the V band, the stars get fainter with increasing metallicity. In the H band, they get brighter. And we can measure that empirically, and we can use that to determine what the effects of metallicity are. The I band, we don't have to worry about it. OK, so the Carnegie-Chicago Hubble program we've been running for several years. We started with Cepheids, and last few years we've been concentrating on the tip of the Red Giant branch. We're using many different facilities, the Magellan telescopes at Las Campanas, Hubble, Spitzer, the Gaia for the parallaxes. This is the TMMT, not to be confused with the TMT. TMT is 30-meter telescope. This is a 300-millimeter telescope. But boy, you can do a lot of really interesting things with a small telescope and future JWST. So our goal is to measure the Hubble constant to 2%, including both statistical and systematic uncertainties, ultimately. We're now just at the sub-3% level, but we will get better. Here's our group. It's a fairly small group for teams these days. You met Insung this morning. And just to point out, Taylor Hoyt, a graduate student working on this, heavily involved. Dylan Hatt just got his thesis, University of Chicago. Rachel Beaton, postdoc now at Princeton, Carnegie Princeton fellow. So the advantage of the tip of the red giant branch is, one is the simplicity. We're measuring a luminosity. It really is a standard candle. We don't have to worry about periods. We don't have to worry about decline rates. It's very simple in that sense. Because we're working in the halo, and you do need to work in the halo, otherwise you're crowded by disk stars in the same way as the Cepheids, the photometry, these stars are isolated, and the photometry is straightforward. The helium flash provides this excellent standard candle. The effects of dust in the halos is minimal, and as I'll describe in a moment, we do need to worry about dust in the calibrator galaxy, and the metallicity effects, particularly at the I band, are minimal. Every generation, every galaxy has a first generation of stars. We know there are metal poor stars there. So we're not looking at the high metallicity stars. In fact, they don't seem to be present in our halos. But there is a blue population that's visible in our data. Empirically, we see them. And there's a good overlap in the characteristics of the local and the distant samples because we can observe these stars in both ellipticals and spirals. So unlike the Cepheids, where they're young, they only occur in spirals, these stars occur in galaxies of all types. So our sample characteristics for the supernova hosts and our local calibrators overlap very nicely. Now, the challenge, they are fainter, as Insung pointed out this morning. Cepheids are brighter in the I band. But Insung did some very nice work where he used the data that the Shoes group had gotten for measurement of Cepheids and the many epochs to determine the periods, co-added those, and then you can measure distances to more distant galaxies. You need longer integration times, but you need those for the Cepheids anyways, but those are separated because of the need to measure periods. The challenge also is in the calibrator galaxies, you need to know the amount of dust. So we've spent a lot of time thinking about how we would measure the amount of dust for the tip of the red giant branch sample themselves in the galaxy, in this case, a large Magellanic cloud that we're using as our calibrator. And I'll get to that momentarily. Small number of calibrators, same problem as for the Cepheids. We have 18 now. Shoes is going to double their sample. They're now at 19. And then the zero-point calibration. We have to have a good calibrator to measure with respect to the target galaxies from HST. So, this is NGC 4258, which we heard about from Mark this morning. Here are the disk fields that Macri et al. Identified Cepheids in several years ago. And you can see just by eye the kinds of problems that we have when we go to measure Cepheid distances. The Cepheids are in the disk. You can see the dust lanes prominently. Star formation occurs in the spiral arms. That's where the surface density is highest. That's where the Cepheids are. So as you go farther out, that becomes worse and worse, as Insung showed this morning. Excuse me. What we do is try and avoid the disk altogether and work out in the halo, where the reddening is very small. Empirically, it turns out to be 0.01, 0.02 at most for the foreground reddenings of the regions that we're looking at. It's generally less than a 1% effect in the uncertainty. And here is the tip that was measured many years ago by Major et al. For NGC 4258. You can see the edge detector here measuring this demarcation between the red giant branch and the asymptotic giant branch. So here are our galaxies. These are the 9 galaxies that we have new data from HST, ranging in distance from 7 megaparsecs at M101 here, out to NGC 1316 and NGC 1365 in the Fornax cluster. We have 5 data, archival data that Insung Jang originally published that we reproduced and to make sure that they were all on a consistent system. And there are 2 additional galaxies, additional supernovae in the Fornax cluster. So that gives a total of 18 tip of the red giant branch calibrators. And this just was put together showing some of the fields that we have. The circles here indicate the red giant branches and just blowing up in the case of M101, where you can actually see the individual giants here with some ease, and you can see how isolated they are. Photometry, this is the nearest galaxy in the sample, but in the other ones are faint but also isolated. And here are the color magnitude diagrams for the 9 galaxies. We have the new photometry. You can see in each case the CMD, the luminosity function, and the edge detection filter. I'll mention, this wasn't a completely blind analysis. It's hard to do for this kind of thing. We're using DAOFO, developed by Peter Stetson. It's what we use for the KEY project, what the SHUES group uses to measure the photometry. But we did blind in the sense of having different subgroups of our team. In every case, for every galaxy, different subgroups analyzed the data independently. There was a group that developed a pipeline, completely automated pipeline, a separate group that used the regular Crankit DAOFO all-frame version, and only after the analyses had been carried out was the comparison made. We did extensive artificial star tests, dropping stars back into the frame, remeasuring where the position of the tip was to understand what both the statistical and the systematic uncertainties were in measuring the position of the tip. So thousands of stars, thousands of simulations. So those are the uncertainties well quantified. And we will eventually make this pipeline available. This is the calibration that we opted on in the absence of new Gaia data. Gaia, as you know, has a 30 microarcsecond offset in the zero point. We opted not to make a correction for that. We'll wait for Gaia to actually have a long enough baseline to measure absolute parallaxes. But the LMC has a long history of distance measurements. They come in at about 18.5 or 18.49 distance modulus. They've been measured by many different techniques. There are Cepheids, there are tip of the red giant branches, attached eclipsing binaries, there's Aurilary stars, there's red clump stars, and so on. A very long history, and the mean is reasonably stable. It's very stable. We made measurements of Cepheids, a sample of stars that have been observed in the near-infrared person at all. We made at Las Campanas many years ago, isolated stars in the LMC, observed them at mid-infrared wavelengths. We had a 3.6 micron period luminosity relation and determined a distance to the LMC of 18.477. It's accidental to three decimal places that it comes out in agreement with the detached eclipsing binary measurement to the LMC that we'll hear about later in the meeting. So that's the calibration, the distance calibration that we use. The tip of the red giant branch is based on data that are obtained from Ogle 3. I want to give a nod to Adam and his group, who had compared the photometry for many different surveys of the LMC. We had been using some of the Zeritsky photometry, likely have crowding effects in the center, but it's very well measured. The tip and the photometry appears to be very stable. Here is the color magnitude diagrams now in the optical, B and I, JHK, these are data from two mass. And so we need to know what the reddening to the TRGB stars is and to that sample. And we had, early on, we were measuring the distances. We published, by the way, distances to galaxies as we went along. And we just used a reddening map that was in the literature. And didn't feel comfortable because we weren't sure that it actually applied to the stars that we were observing, the TRGB stars. So we developed a method recently that makes use of the TRGB stars themselves. This is a schematic diagram showing the absolute magnitude as a function of color here. This is an infrared color. At I band here, once you constrain the slope in one wavelength, you are constrained mathematically. You know what the slopes at the other wavelengths are. We're using the same sample of stars defined in the I band. We can identify those at different bands. And you can see that the effect of metallicity is you get brighter as you go to the infrared, and you get fainter as you go to the optical. That's not what extinction does. We can separate the effects of metallicity and extinction, and we don't need to rely on theoretical models. Adam showed theoretical models yesterday extending to very high metallicities. Empirically, we're not even seeing those stars in the halos. We don't use them. We're using the bluer, oldest stars for this calibration. They're the ones we're using to measure the tip. So if you do this extrapolation for the metal-rich stars, you'll be way off in the blue. But we're measuring in the blue. We don't extrapolate to the red. And so you can then use the direct data for the Large Magellanic Cloud. We've also used the Small Magellanic Cloud, and we've used IC-1613. These are two nearby galaxies that are known to have very low foreground reddening. And we can difference those in the way that we developed the method early on for Cepheids and measure as a function of inverse wavelength here, this is an extinction law. It does not match what you find for the metallicity. We have taken out the metallicity component. So we can measure the reddening and the extinction for the TRGB stars themselves, and not just rely on the value in the literature, which we did early on. We've done this now for the TRGB stars. Just schematically, just showing here the effect on the absolute magnitude that we are adopting for the calibration of the tip of the red giant branch. We land at minus 4.05. We determine a reddening of EB minus V of 0.095 and a value of the Hubble constant of 69.8. We do have some constraints because the reddening can't be less than zero, and the foreground reddening generally is somewhere in the range of 0.03 to 0.06. We're measuring the total reddening. It falls between the range of other methods that have been used to measure reddenings for other types of stars in the LMC, very similar to what's been measured for the R lotteries, which is not inconsistent. So if we compare now the distances from the Cepheids to distances obtained using tip of the red giant branch, the points in gray are from the literature. These are nearby objects. They're too nearby. They haven't had any type 1a supernovae, but the agreement is very good. The scatter is very small. And then the red points here are the overlap sample that we have that also have type 1a supernovae. So we're going from the LMC at a distance of 50 kiloparsecs out to 30 megaparsecs. And this is just a blow up of the red points in the earlier plot. You can see the scatter is larger for the supernova sample. Now that's something we don't yet understand. You can see that the scatter is larger than what would be implied by the error bars. It could be in either one of the Cepheid or the TRGB sample or both, but it's indicating that the errors are somehow underestimated. And if we look closely at this is now just a simple Hubble diagram, so it's not redshift, this is velocity versus distance for these nearby objects. We don't have to worry about cosmology at this point. The black points are points in common that have both TRGB and Cepheid distances. The scatter in the TRGB distances actually less than it is in the Cepheid distances. And remember, these have the same peculiar velocities. They're the same galaxies. We also see that the scatter in the supernova magnitudes, and these are the supercell sample, this is not the CSP sample in this particular case, is smaller for the TRGB than it is for the Cepheids. The Cepheids show larger scatter. And the TRGB matches more closely what we're seeing with the distant supernovae. The scatter is about a tenth of a magnitude in the CSP sample. So there seems to be something that is larger, leading to larger scatter in the Cepheids than in the TRGB. So that's statistical uncertainty, but it's interesting. And the supernova sample that we use, I mentioned, is the Carnegie Supernova Project sample. It's a well-observed sample of supernovae, about 100 supernovae, light curves that have very high cadence. We have spectra also that have very high cadence. I got to move, it's a very nice sample. Paid a lot of attention to systematics and minimizing systematics. Here is our Hubble diagram. And now, the points in red are the calibrators, the TRGB calibrators. They have been corrected for peculiar velocities, but that doesn't impact the Hubble constant. That has nothing to do with it. Just simply correcting them, we could have left them in and shown the peculiar velocity errors. They've been corrected, but they don't. That doesn't. The distances alone are used in determining the Hubble constant. So here we've defined this is how we did redshifts, Tamara. We fit the parameters, the time and maximum, light curve shape. And the magnitude at each magnitude, at each maximum for the 9 filters. This is the program that Chris Burns wrote called Snoopy. That's input for an MCMC analysis where we simultaneously now are solving for the slope of the color correction, the K-corrected magnitudes, and the slope of the correlation between peak luminosity and the host galaxy mass, and we get a value of H-naught along with a full covariance matrix. So the difference with shoes, it's not simply the photometric zero point that comes into it, and that has changed. We have diverged in recent times. That has come about because of the difference in the calibrating sample we're using, the Ogle photometry, which we believe is a better data set. We concur with Adam Riess and his group that is the case, and our now ability to correct for reddening for the TRGB stars directly, and not just use a reddening map over the whole galaxy. We differ in how we fit the light curves. We differ in how we do the photometry. We have different supernova samples. Even in the case where we overlap, the different galaxies have different weightings. For example, 4424, which has a Cepheid distance based on 4 Cepheids, you downweight, Adam. We have a good TRGB distance, so even within that sample, we weight it differently. So many different reasons. We analyze the data differently. We're using an MC-MC analysis, and the SHOES group are using a maximum likely and matrix inversion. So I think this is a positive thing. This is completely different analysis, completely different data, completely different systematics of the different methods. And that's where we are landing. And I showed you these at the beginning, but that's where we would be on our own. This is the comparison with only 4258 and the Milky Way. So these now are completely independent determinations. If we just combine the TRGB and the Cepheids, that's where we end up. It's a 3.7 sigma difference with Planck. And I'll just say a couple words about the future, and I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the next few years. I think a real game changer for us is going to be the availability of Gaia parallaxes, and we will have a sub-percent calibration of the distance scale, both for the Cepheids and the TRGB. That's unheard of in the distance scale. It's hard to imagine, but it's coming. We will be able to improve the calibration of the LMC. We already have time at Las Campanas with Magellan to try and improve the reddenings. Adam mentioned yesterday, JWST is going to be a great TRGB measuring machine. It will allow us to go into the infrared. The stars are brighter. We can survey to larger volumes, and we can increase the numbers of supernovae that we can calibrate. Sadly, we can't do that for the Cepheids because of the crowding issues and the fact that it's in the infrared. The Cepheids are blue. So let me just conclude by saying we have measured an entirely independent distance scale based on the TRGB. So it's parallel to the Cepheids, but completely independent of it. And just to remind you, we're looking at completely different populations, old metal poor halo stars compared to young metal rich disk stars. The physics of the helium flash is completely different than the pulsation of Cepheid variables. The lines of sight to the supernova host galaxies are completely different. They're unrelated. Is there new physics? I think that's going to depend on whether we can show that systematic errors have been eliminated. I think the remaining systematics of note are the absolute calibration of the distance scale. We're still using small numbers of calibrators. We've got, in the case of the Cepheids, the Milky Way, NGT 4258, and the LMC, that's still a small number of calibrators. And as we heard from Mark this morning, there's no hope of getting any more Maser distances. That's the universe we're stuck with. Scatter in the small numbers of supernova calibrators. As I showed you, it's smaller for the tip of the Red Giant branch than for the Cepheids. But as we increase the numbers of calibrators, that we will strengthen that calibration. And for us, the primary uncertainty and something that we can continue to do better on is measuring the extinction for the LMC. And I've pretty much gone through how we will improve with Gaia and the and JWST. I'll just give a nod to the LIGO sirens, which we hope we will be getting many more of soon, and the strong gravitational lensing. And I think ultimately we are going to need several independent methods that are each accurate and precise to, we would hope, 1%. I think that's a very tough goal, but better than 2%. And only then will we be convinced that we have put constraints on the systematics, not just the statistical uncertainties. So I think a precision and accuracy at the percent level with multiple routes to ascertain the systematic uncertainties is feasible, but in my view, it remains a formidable challenge. And I will stop there and leave you with that.
Okay, questions. I see several. 1, 2. Let me start here and then go there.
Thanks. I completely understand this great idea of having really independent local distance ladders. My question, though, is what if you make the steps as similar as possible between the Cepheid-based and the tRGB-based calibration. You use LMC for both. You use the same Hubble Flow supernova sample. Maybe that doesn't make much difference, I'm not sure. What then do you get for, in terms of a direct consistency check there?
Yeah, that has diverged somewhat. We had this meeting a few months ago where we were on the same scale. The LMC now, you guys are getting 74.22, if I'm recalling correctly, using LMC alone.
Right, that's, I think, what was in the paper, yeah.
Yeah.
But, Graham, you can't do them the same because you have to estimate things that are specific to, let's say, tRGB, like the peak of the tRGB and the extinction of the tRGB. So
no, I understand.
The same distance,
yeah.
They have to diverge because you have to estimate different quantities.
But some of the error budget of both is common because you've used the LMC and you've used the same Hubble Flow supernovae, so there's still a meaningful consistency check. It's not trivial. No, I see. Yeah,
that's the. It would be nice if it was just a trivial add, and it isn't. There are lots of factors, including the weighting that causes you to diverge, even when you're using the same sample. So it actually is not that close. When you use LMC, when you use the same 10 galaxies, for both tRGB and Cepheids, and you use the LMC, and then you could use the SuperCal sample, and we are still significantly lower. We get 71 point something. They're still at 74. We would go up. Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Right. So I noticed that supernova 2005 KE was your poster child for the 1As used, but it's a 91 BG-like event. So it seems that you're using 91 BG-likes. Do you know what part of your sample is? Does that reflect confidence in the burns?
Yeah,
stretching?
So the Snoopy routine, so we did a lot of jackknife tests throwing out things that, either were the fast decliners or the BG-like events, and we don't see any difference. So Snoopy seems to do a very good job of fitting things so that it doesn't matter if we include them in the sample or not. Our statistics are better if we include them.
Wendy. Very nice talk. Can you go over this point of, so when you're fitting the slopes for different filters, you have, can you explain how you have one slope, but these different galaxies have different metallicities. So how does it all work?
The different galaxies, so out in the halo, we're actually observing a fairly small range in color. I mean, we can actually see the range in color, which of course is dependent on the reddening, but we're not observing at really high V minus I colors, right? We're observing approximately V minus I of 1.6, and that's common to the galaxies. So we can see. Where I'm trying to find for you. Sorry. In the different galaxies, so I was going to go back to the other one, but so we can identify the stars at the I band. We know where they fall in the H and K bands, right? So these are stars of different metallicity. That's the beauty of the tip of the red giant branch method, is that the color tracks the metallicity. So unlike the Cepheids, where we don't know what it is, these are the highest metallicity ones that we're actually observing, and we can observe. Yeah, but age is very small. Again, when you're out in the halo and it's, over 4 gigayears. True.
This includes the halo of the
LMC. And as you saw from Insung's simulations, right, even includes a range of ages, that's not a big effect. You're still dominated by the
I thought that was just I band. Right?
No, because you know where the stars are along here, right? They're the same stars. The high metallicity ones are here, the low metallicity ones are here. That's true here and here. They track. They're the same stars. That's the beauty of this method. We can use the stars themselves.
I came in here from the CMB side thinking, okay, well, eventually they'll come down to meet us. And then yesterday I came out of here thinking, wow, okay, we have a crisis. And now I'm thinking maybe we just have a crisis of crises. And so I'm trying to figure out how we go forward here. I like you, actually remember 50 versus 100 arguments. now we're kind of in a miniature scale here, but what is your, you know, maybe you and, so, and he can duke it out somewhere, I don't know.
You know, I think we're seeing the difficulty of using one method. If we put all our eggs in the Cepheid basket, we will never uncover the unknown unknowns, right? That's the nature of systematic errors. And so I think it's important to do this in other ways because we're going to learn about systematics we might not have understood. And I think, you know, if you look at the error bars of what Sandage and DeVoeckler were claiming, they didn't overlap. And they couldn't even imagine some of the systematics that we were able to uncover when we finally got HST data. And I think every time you get an increase, a jump in precision and accuracy, you learn something. And then you really need that next jump. And I think for us, it's going to be Gaia. I think the parallaxes are going to help a lot. I think right now we can say, okay, we've got HST parallaxes, and they seem consistent with what people are saying for the offset from the Gaia parallaxes, and they seem consistent with the photometry for, you know, the ones that were observed with HST. But we don't, you know, until we measure that directly and empirically, we don't know. Maybe there's still a systematic there. With the Cepheids in the disk, again, you know, I think Adam convincingly shows that there, when he does a elimination of stars in the PL relation, that it has a distribution that's Gaussian in log flux. It doesn't make a lot of sense because how does that happen? How does it become symmetric? So, well, you know, but is there a tail that is, you know, maybe it's not symmetric in flux and it looks like, you know, a truncated log normal distribution might look like a normal distribution. I don't know. But I do worry, you know, I've spent a lot of time working on Cepheids. I spent a lot of time worrying about crowding effects. I think up to a certain limit you do well, and we see that with the nearby objects, they agree really well. It's only when we get to the supernova sample that we see this divergence. So something's happening at larger distances. I think, you know, we're going to need to pay attention to that.
We'll get to Tommaso in just a second. Just one answer to your question, I think, is that these two don't disagree significantly.
We agree to 1.7 sigma.
Yeah,
okay, there's, so there's it's...
No tension. My sigma went to 2 sigma.
No, but there's no tension between the TR giant and the Cepheids. Okay, Tommaso and then... Adam and then Brent.
Hi, Wendy. So, I'm trying to see how I can combine this information. And there was one thing that confuses me is that there's an overlap in the Supernova 1A calibrator samples between SHOES and CCHP, right? You have those 10 objects that are in common. And it's true that the distances are independent because one is TRGB and the other one is Cepheids, but the luminosities are not because they're the same supernovae. So the two measurements are not completely in the sense independent in the sense that if those 10 calibrators were over-luminous or under-luminous in some sense, that would propagate to both measurements. So if I were to say, and this seems to me that's one of the dominant parts of the error budget, right, those calibrators.
Well, so, you know, given also, so we can do the supernovae that are not in common.
Right, but then it's so, not that,
you know,
many.
It's small number statistics.
That's
again,
right.
We're, you know, a sample less than 20 at most.
And you have
and
10 in common.
And then 10 that overlap, 8 that don't. But, you know, we can play that small numbers game, and you're not seeing big differences. I mean, I take your point, but...
So, I mean, as a user of this information, I'm thinking, how do I combine if these two measurements, can they be combined? Should they be combined, or should they be considered as partially covariant? Because
well, you know, again, we're both using supernovae. If there's a problem with the supernovae, now we have a different sample of supernovae, so you know, we're minimizing systematics to that extent, or we have different systematics. But we're using supernovae, so that's why I think we really do need different methods. So you know, Dan, get to work, find some more. You know, we we'll get to the bottom of it. And I think, you know, we designed the KEY project to do 5 different distance methods. And I think why in the end we felt confident about the 10% error bar was we actually had designed it so that the statistical uncertainties would be 5%. And we had that luxury then because we could do that. We can't design now a test that would have 0.5% for many different methods. It doesn't exist. And it's a lot more work to go from 10% to 5% or 5% to 2%. And so, you know, now there are bigger groups doing different things, but we're only getting to the point where we're comparing different kinds of methods. And I think that's essential. And I don't think we're going to believe our systematics until we finally have independent methods with statistical uncertainties that are small, and then we'll learn about the systematics. And I think that's where we are. That's just reality.
Wendy, by the way, just to answer your question, I mean, there have been, I think we'll see a summary at the end, there's been 5 sort of fairly independent results presented so far, so you don't have to just look at 2. I think for the first time we're seeing many, and so the dream of getting there, I think, is getting there. I want to understand, when I look at the TRGB results, and I want to try to understand them, you know, my easiest way, because I'm not an expert, is to compare to the previous and see what has evolved. And so, Insung presented before that that TRGB was only 2/100 of a magnitude, plus or minus 0.03 off from where we were in 2016. And I just checked with Insung, and that was using all 3 anchors. So all 3 anchors was H naught of 73. So we were, TRGB was there. And what's different in your paper, I understand why, is the absolute calibration changed from minus 3.97 to minus 4.05. So that's 0.08 of a magnitude. I understand that, okay? And when I unpack where did it come from, there's a 0.06 of a magnitude change in the amount of extinction from Insung's paper to your guys' current paper for the LMC. I understand that. I have some questions about the method that you're using for extinction, because I still think there's a metallicity dependence when you use it at different slopes. But what surprises me is the uncertainty you assign to your extinction is 0.02 magnitudes. So, you know, not only are you different than the previous iteration, but by 3 sigma. It seems like a big shift in the amount of dust. And I'm just asking, since each paper has used a different method for dust, do you think metallicity could be causing that shift?
I think it's unlikely that metallicity is causing the shift for the reason that I showed you. I think we are tracking metallicity. We see what the effect of metallicity is on the colors of the stars.
But your paper does use one slope, and there are 2 different slopes when you get off of the I band. There's an age slope and a metallicity slope. So I'm just, how are you doing that?
Okay, you know, we have a paper that will describe this in great detail, but you know, the fact is we have many galaxies, first of all, that we can test the slope with.
Right. I don't mean the LMC-SMC or LMC to IC-6013, just the calibration step. That's the only part I don't get.
Yeah, so I mean, to answer your point, so you know, when we, as I said, we published the galaxy distances as we went along. When we first encountered, okay, what are we, we have a distance to the LMC, what's the reddening? We looked at what people had done, we looked at the reddening maps that were out there, and we took, as you did, right, in your recent email, you took something that was from the literature from Hasky et al, and it seemed reasonable. The issue is, one, that's a very low reddening value. It's equal to or less than most of the foreground estimates. And so, you know, people, as you know, write to you and say, why are you using such a low reddening? And we were worried about it because it didn't apply to the TRGB stars themselves. And what we had developed for the Cepheids, as you know, was a way of measuring W and dealing with the reddening for the Cepheids themselves. And so we spent a lot of time thinking, how could we do that? And I think, you know, if you look at the, you know, we don't want to do this theoretically. I mean, what you showed yesterday, that's extending way beyond the metallicity of anything that we're observing. We are staying, I mean, they don't go that red.
But only in the calibration step you do. You go from the LMC to IC-1613, so that's almost 1.5 decks.
Yeah, but we see the overlap in those two.
But I'm saying, and maybe Barry knows this better, but isn't your slope set at the LMC? And so you're getting the age effect there. I could totally see that. It's just when you apply it to some galaxy like IC-1613, which is metal poor, now the slope shifts in bands that are not.
We don't see any slope changes with metallicity.
But the Padova models say that you should.
Well, you want to base the distance scale on theory?
Well, I don't see empirical data sets for determining that separation. I mean, there's a nice paper by Kristen McQuinn that goes into this. There's 2 different slopes, and it causes a bias.
I have a problem with that paper. We can discuss it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we really should sit down and discuss this, because there are a lot of issues.
Okay, well, I've also been working with the TRGB method. I can first of all say that we've analyzed essentially all the same galaxies. And we come to very good agreement with what you've been doing, but that's with the zero point as it has been standing. and you're bringing into question this revision of the zero point. Our own zero point was not based on the LMC. It was based on nearby spheroidal galaxies, Fornax and a couple of other ones, and establishing their distances from the RR Lyrae and the horizontal branch. Now that's a work that was done a decade ago and should be revised or should be looked at again for sure. And of course with Gaia coming along. But that is quite an independent. I'll just say and finally here that we use as a calibration for our distances both TRGB and Cepheids. We'd found them in those two methods to be in agreement, and we've applied it to 18,000 galaxies in our database, and our preferred Hubble constant is 75 plus or minus 2.
Yeah, a comment about the issue of crowding with the Cepheids and the dependence of distance. This is something that we became very worried about 3 years ago, started looking into very carefully. One of the things we realized pretty quickly is that of our anchors, one of them, 4058, is actually one of the most crowded objects in among all. So in other words, our anchors span the range from not crowded to very crowded. And there is no real difference. There is also no real difference or dependence of the supernova calibration with distance. So it seems very hard to think that there could be something hiding in this issue of crowding for the Cepheids. It's a hard problem.
Yeah, sure. I agree. It's a hard problem. I just take a note from Dan Skolnick, this morning, who said it's really useful when you publish your data. And I know that Chris Burns tried to get from you the Cepheid data before you'd done the outlier rejection, and nobody's seen that. So everybody has analyzed the same data after rejection, and so we don't know what got rejected or whether there's, we just don't know. So again, it's useful to publish data in a form that other people can look at it and understand what the issues are. And yes, I think we just don't know.
Well, but wouldn't you expect some dependence on distance, on redshift, if you will, if there was an effect with crowding?
I agree with you. You're spanning the whole range in 4258, and I think the issue is as you get into the disk, it's of course the giants that are crowding the Cepheids at the H band, right? Yeah. And this becomes worse and worse as you go to larger and larger distances.
I'm talking about the actual measured crowding.
Yeah, no, I understand.
There's no dependence. There's no residuals with this.
Yes. I do have a question, though.
See that effect.
We don't see it in the Cepheids.
I do have a question. If you did the same thing we did, I mean, you had very, very, very nice measurement of the TRGB for 4058. What would happen if you took that as the anchor instead of the LMC?
Yeah, we're in the process of using the pipeline that we've developed so that we do everything in a self-consistent way, and we will do that. That's coming.
Because then you would not have the issue of reddening or anything like that.
Yeah, well, we have some, but less. Yeah.
We're going to have two more questions because it's so exciting, and that's it.
Can you say something about how the galaxies and supernovae were chosen? Did you pick galaxies to study that were already in the Carnegie supernova program, or are there other supernovae out there that there may be data?
No, nature chose them for us. They're just close enough that you could actually measure a TRGB distance to them. And that's another thing that's going to improve over time, right? More supernovae will come in and we will be able to increase that sample, but yet it's just...
But are there supernovae out there yet to be analyzed that were in some
galaxies?
Well,
we have three of time to do three more, so we're observing, in fact, starting this month to observe three more galaxies, but there's not a whole lot of choice. We're going to have...
So what sets
the... JWST will be able to go out to larger
distances. But is it just a cut in distance, or is something about the galaxy that you needed to...
No. Just can we detect? Can we get an high signal noise measurement? We don't want to push this too far because then you're just degrading your accuracy.
Okay, Lucas. And then that's it. Okay, so let's thank everybody.